this evening's spring training special of the Metsian Podcast. There's much to discuss, so without further delay, I want to bring my partners in podcasting crime on the scene. What can I say? You may know him from a Bedford and Sullivan podcast. You may know him as a filmmaker. You may know him as the man formerly known as a converted Mets fan. I know him as a friend. He's coming to us live from the Broadway Diner in Bayonne, New Jersey. Sam Maxwell, everyone.
What is going on? Thank you so much for that lovely introduction, Mike. And yeah, you know, I have been discovering the Jersey Diners, which definitely give both Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and Long Island, as well as the city, a run for its money. I always think when it comes to the city, I think coffee shops more than diners.
Well, you know what? I'm glad you brought that up, because diners, it seems, are a dying breed here in Brooklyn. Anyway, without further delay, my other partner in podcast crime, hailing from Connecticut, about 20 miles north of WWE headquarters, a Beatles connoisseur and a fellow Giants fan. I call him my more sensible brother from another mother. You can get him on Twitter at MetFanRich, Mr. Rich Spirago. Hello, sir.
Hey, thank you, Mike. Thanks for a nice introduction. And drive by the WWE building both on the way to and from Citi Field every time I go. And, talking about diners, diners really are a dying breed, aren't they? You know, up here in Connecticut, we certainly have them still, but they've definitely gone by the wayside. You know, Starbucks, it's more coffee shops now. It's more that. It's designer coffee. Much more so than the good old-fashioned diner where you'd, you know, meet your buddies and solve the problems of the world, right?
I guess so. that is just a sign that we're getting old and things are just passing us by. Times are changing, as they say. 18 days left till opening day, boys. So let's do a quick around the horn, so to say, before we get to our main topic, which is unavoidable, the health and status of the franchise, Tom Seaver. We'll get into that a little later in the show, but for now, let's get, as they say on the radio, the candy shop stuff out of the way first. I think we start with catcher, and just your gut feelings, guys. And before you even get started on that, just give me your impressions. Here we are, March 10th, Grapefruit League is in full swing. So give me your impressions of spring training thus far. But let's start with catcher. It's, your gut feeling. Who do you want to go in as the backup, Devin Mesoraco or Travis Darnell? Sam, start.
You know, we've been watching Travis Darnell for a long time. Rich and I have kind of very much voiced that we are a little weary of the whole TDA experiment. And he's a good kid. It's just unfortunate that he's never been able to give himself a chance. Out there. He had a great 2015 when he was able to come back from injury, and he's a big reason why we made the playoffs. But at this point, I mean, you got Mesoraco behind a Cy Young Award season with Jacob deGrom as his main catcher. Off the top of my head, I got to go with Devin Mesoraco.
What's your gut feeling, Rich?
Same. Today, if anybody watched the game today, that was TDA in a nutshell. He comes up and he hits an absolute bomb. I mean, it was more like it was a line drive, as Keith Hernandez said. It got out of the ballpark in about a nanosecond, and you're like, wow, this guy can hit. You know, then you think about it, but then it's glimpses. Darno is glimpses, and you'll see glimpses of what you thought you were getting when the trade went down. Ferrari Dickey, but then he gets hurt, and then he goes into these long funks, and then he can't throw anybody out at second base, and he's not blocking balls in the dirt, but then he hits another home run, so you get these little glimpses of greatness from him, or promise, probably is a better word. So with all that said, he doesn't profile as a backup catcher. Typically backup catchers are good defensively. They're comfortable in the role. they do it once or twice a week. And saying that, you're pretty much describing Devin Mesoraco. I mean, he would catch DeGrom every time because DeGrom wants it that way, and your Cy Young winner wants it, you do it. And, you know, Mesoraco is a hard-nosed kind of a guy. He can hit a little bit. He's got some pop. You know, defensively, he'll run through a brick wall. He'll block balls in the dirt. He himself also struggles with, you know, throwing runners out sometimes. But if you look at the two of them, I have to go with Mesoraco. You know, you have the DeGrom factor and the fact that he just profiles better as a backup catcher. And maybe you could get something for a TDA. He'd have to go. You can't keep all three of them, in my opinion.
I'll borrow a little bit from the both of you, Sam. You know, I'm a little tired of the TDA experiment as well. And Rich, from you, defensively, he would be my choice as well. First base. Let me put it to you this way. Peter Alonso hit another dinger over the Green Monster Jr. All things being equal, let's say him and Dom Smith have fine, outstanding springs. Does Dom Smith get the nod over Alonso for seniority's sake, Sam?
That's a great question. I mean, I'm somebody who has a customized Dom Smith T-shirt. So I've been rooting for Dom ever since he was drafted. I don't know how to answer that properly because, you know, it's been the weight issue. It's been the attitude issue. It's been all these different things. And you got to wonder, though, I'm not sure exactly what the options are with Dom Smith, and maybe one of you can help me out since I unfortunately don't have internet right now. But I'd still have to say, I mean, Pete Alonso has become such the golden boy that I still think the only thing that would stop it is if we're talking Super 2, and they're finally just like, all right, Dom, you had a great spring. You've been working your ass off for the last few years, especially the last 2 years. Show us what you got in September. And if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. Pete Alonso's coming up once his Super 2 status clears. That's the only thing I can think about. Because otherwise, like, it's just the trendiest thing is Peter Alonso right now. You know, whether or not I agree with it, I want the best for the Mets. That's the bottom line. So I want Dom Smith to succeed, but I could see the Super 2 status getting in the way.
That's a great point. I haven't looked into that. You know, if you know that for sure, that's an excellent point. So, Rich, same question. Now, Dominic Smith, he's having a productive season, you know, a productive Grapefruit League to date. Same question. Does Dominic Smith get seniority over Alonso?
I don't think so. I will go with what Sam said. I think Pete Alonso is the fair-haired boy of the organization right now. I think hard as it is to say this about a guy who's never spent a day in the major leagues, it might be his job to lose. And Brody Van Wagenen came out, you know, to the point, yes, that is a real thing about service time, but he came out and he has said a couple of times that if Pete Alonso wins the job, it doesn't matter about the extra year of team control, that he'll bring him north. So when I look at Dom Smith, you have a guy who's carrying around some baggage. You know, like Sam said, the weight, the attitude, the basically not successful time in the major leagues when he has had his opportunities, although he did show some flashes, to be fair. But, you know, he's carrying around that baggage, and it just seems like the bright light is shining on Pete Alonso. The fans want Pete Alonso, and he's hitting these enormous. I mean, I was watching that game yesterday. He hit it completely out of JetBlue Park. He's just the sexy choice now, you know, with what he did in AAA and what he did in the Fall League and all of that. And Brody's like, look, it's all about winning. It's not about an extra year of control. So you put all that on the table, everything I just said on the table, I can't see Dom Smith beating Pete Alonso out for the job. I really can't.
And if you remember, one of Brody's first acts as general manager was to go down and speak with him. Remember?
Yes.
So I find that
that
very interesting. Yeah. So let's move on over to second base. It's funny. No news is good news, right? We haven't heard anything about Robinson Cano, negative or otherwise. So I guess that's a good thing. That and, you know, unfortunately, T.J. Rivera has been released. I hate to see that happen, being that he's a native New Yorker. But other than that, you know, baseball, it is what it is. So, Chance, you want to start with that one?
Yeah, let's start with the whole T.J. Rivera thing. Obviously, I always root for a hometown boy to succeed, especially when he hits the way T.J. Rivera was. It's one of those contact things. He got the barrel to the ball. And the thing is that we've talked about the plethora of infielders and ones who haven't been injured for the last 2 years with Tommy John surgery. He's apparently been having trouble getting into game shape, even though he's quoted as saying that he's in the best, you know, one of those I'm in the best shape of my life type of things. And I think he said he's in the best shape he's been in a long time. But when you look at it, the writing's on the wall. The move totally makes sense with the plethora of infielders they have. And this is one moment where I have to say, you know, as surprising as people found it when it happened, I didn't find it all that surprising at all. And you kind of have to, in some fashion, applaud the move because we're not thinking about the emotional. Brody's not thinking about the emotional element of it. He's doing what's necessary to free up a roster space that could go to Danny Espinosa, somebody who has more experience having major league success. So, no, I don't think that it was surprising at all. And I don't necessarily, as you know, I wish T.J. Rivera the best. He's a good kid. You can tell he's a good kid. What's funny is, like, he's probably only, at this point, you know, I'm talking like he's, you know, this kid, and he's probably only, like, 3 years younger than me. But going to Cano real quick, I remember a lot of people always dogged him for maybe sometimes he would run a little slow to first base, but the thing that I always heard was, you know, how free and easy he was in second base and that he you know, was lazy out there. But the way watching, you know, we've had the chance as New York baseball fans to see Cano in action one way or the other, even if we're not Yankee fans. And the thing I always found about Robinson Cano is he's just that good. He gets to the ball. He's smooth. He just glides over to the ball. And if he can stay healthy and he still has anything that he has had over the course of his career, you know, we could be looking at a sleeper success over at second base.
Rich, take us up the middle with shortstop. Robinson Cano, T.J. Rivera, and start us with Ahmed Rosario. His injury turned out being nothing much. He's back. He hit a home run. So take it away.
Well, you know, Cano so far, and, you know, geez, we're talking about a thimbleful of exposure here as a Met, but Cano so far is doing exactly what we could have hoped for. You know, he's hitting the ball. He's going the other way a lot. Keith noted that the other day when I think it was Friday. He noted that Cano's going the other way a lot. He hit an absolute beautiful home run in, I think it was also Friday's game, with that incredible swing of his. You know, playing solid defense. I think he's hitting like 310, 315 over the spring. So that's what the Mets wanted when they got him. You know, a guy who would give you good defense, hit the ball over the field, you know, show the power that just comes naturally for him. So the key with Cano is going to be to not, you know, to remember he's 36, and I know that that's the plan. They want him to play about 130 games and just do that. You know, just please keep this guy healthy because this guy's a force. This guy is an absolute force when he's at the plate. T.J. Rivera, I feel sorry for him. I mean, you know, you hate to see anybody lose a job because of an injury. Tommy John is so, you know, you hear about it, Matt Wieters, other players, you know, Didi Gregorius, but it's still fairly uncommon for a position player. So it's like, oh, man, that sucks, a poor guy. And he just couldn't come back, and you know he was trying because of his you know, his career and all of that. He's that kind of a guy. He's a scrappy kind of a guy. So you know the guy was busting his ass to get healthy, and it just didn't happen. So you feel bad for him. Not like Sam said, I'm not surprised he was released. They have way too many bodies, so you wish him well. And then Rosario, look, I think he's a star in the making. I think he absolutely will be a star. You saw the second half last year. He was stealing bases, and he was hitting the ball with authority. playing good defense. He's very smooth out there. You know, he looked great today. So what I worry about is what we saw Monday. You know, when he got hit in the hand, and first thing I was thinking is, oh, that's a broken bone. He'll be out for 2 months, and who's going to play shortstop? Well, you have Echevarria, but there's a, you know, kind of a drop-off there. So Rosario, in summary, I think he's a star in the making. I fully expect that for him, and I just hope he stays healthy like anybody else. I have to tell you, I was mopping my brow a little when he got hit. I was really worried, but, you know, thank goodness he's okay.
I was worried as well, and I couldn't echo your sentiments more. Sam, third base, I'm going to play a little trick on you. Last week we discussed the injuries to Jed Lowrie and Todd Frazier. Now, Jeff McNeil, is he about to become the next Wilmer Flores in the sense that they're going to jerk him around from position to position?
That's a great question. You know, it might be a blessing in disguise because I loved his defense out there wherever he was playing. I mean, he was playing second base last year, but, you know, we haven't seen him at third base as much as we've seen him at second base. But, you know, one way or the other, Jed Lowrie, he's had injury history. Todd Frazier, he's had an injury history. And we were obviously hoping that when the Jed Lowrie signing, he was coming off an insane year, but, you know, woe is us, as they say. I hope that he doesn't become – I think he's going to be a better fielder than Wilmer Flores ever was. And so that alone will make it – you know, I don't think the reason why they were jerking Wilmer Flores around was – basically, Wilmer Flores couldn't claim a spot. He wasn't good defensively anywhere. I don't see that yet from Jeff McNeil. You know, he was really solid at second base last year, better than I've ever seen Wilmer Flores be in the infield. So one way or the other, I was a little wary of the fact that they were trying him in the outfield because this kid can hit, and I just want him to hit. You know, just go put him somewhere so he can hit, one way or the other. And that would be the only concern about jerking him around. But other than that, you know, Wilmer Flores made, you know, part of the reason why his bed was made the way it was because he just was terrible defensively no matter where you put him. And I just don't see that with McNeil.
Rich, what say you?
Yeah, I like the fact that McNeil might be in the infield. I know it's unfortunate Frazier's injury is what's causing it, but, you know, Mike, you and I have talked about this. I don't – to get his bat in the lineup and put him in the outfield, oh, you know, not my favorite thing to do. The fact that he can now play third base and you get that good bat in the lineup, I think it kind of worked out. You know, McNeil can hit. Let's face it, he can hit. And when Frazier comes back, if you have to figure something out, you figure something out. But the current situation, I think, is actually preferable to the plan, where you have McNeil playing the infield, which is where he belongs. You have his bat in the lineup, and will he be the next Wilmer Flores and all of that? I'm gonna throw a different one at you, Mike. I'm gonna say he's the next Ben Zobrist. You know, Ben Zobrist plays a lot of positions. He plays them all, as far as I could tell, adequately. He's not bad at any of them. Certainly he's a better second base than anything else, but he's played shortstop in his career. I know they've played him a little bit at third, a lot of second, some outfield. So maybe the Mets have a Ben Zobrist, a guy who can play adequately at all positions, maybe a little bit above average at some. And he doesn't embarrass you in the field. He's not a liability, and he's in there for his bat. And maybe that's what the Mets have. Maybe they have a younger version of Ben Zobrist.
And they kind of look alike when you think about it, too.
Real quick about the bullpen, because I want to get into BBW's hires as special advisors real quick. But Kyle Dougherty, he's not looking so good. And he, you know, he has Rule 5 and 25-man roster implications. How important is he to the bullpen, Sam?
You know, I have to admit, I'm not really brushed up on this Rule 5 pick right now. And if he's not doing well,
They have to keep him on the 25-man roster or else relinquish him back to his originating team.
Yes. And, you know, this is why these guys get exposed for Rule 5, is that they've showed flashes before, but they not enough to keep protected after a certain amount of time. The one concern I have is that I saw that Drew Smith got injured, and he's being rushed back to New York to see what's going on. The only concern is the bodies, but at the same time, if he's not performing well, you know, he better get his act together. Otherwise, he's going to have to go to the team that gave him up.
Rich?
Yeah, I think of him as being sort of window dressing. I mean, famous last words, but I think the bullpen is pretty solid. And if Doughty doesn't make it and he has to return, so be it. I mean, these guys, if you really think about it, how many Rule 5 picks do you know really work out for the team that takes them? There are a few. There are certainly a few. But remember Brad Esmus?
Brad Esmus.
Right? And it's like, okay. There's a reason why these guys aren't protected, you know, and they haven't, and they find themselves subject to the Rule 5 draft. Now, sometimes it could be a very good team that doesn't have a spot, but there's probably a reason why this guy was available, and if he doesn't do well and he has to go back, I'll go to battle with the bullpen they have without Kyle Doughty.
Can I just say this, Mike, before you pick back up, Mike, about it? There's only one person that I can think of that should have never been exposed in the Rule 5, and we're going to be talking about him very
shortly. Yeah, exactly. It was actually different. Yeah, right. Same basic concept, right.
Yeah. Well, that said, I think that's a wrap on the players, unless there's one particular player that stands out that we haven't spoken about yet. Sam, do you have a player in mind?
Not off the top of my head, no. I mean, 18 days. Let's do this. Let's go, guys.
Sam?
I do.
I have one. Yeah, go for it.
I wanted to ask you guys your opinion on Edwin Diaz and him not signing the contract and, sort of like, I shouldn't say pouting, but saying, look, this is BS and I don't want to sign this. Now, I know he's not the first person in Mets history to do that, certainly not the first person in baseball history, but it is interesting. You pick this guy up, American League leader in saves. He comes over and, the team does what the team has a right to do, which is put the contract in front of him for what they have to pay him. And he's not happy. He doesn't sign it. He'll get over it, I'm sure, and he has a lot of years ahead of him to make a lot of money. Hopefully those are with the Mets. But what do you guys think about that? Do you think the Mets could have made a show and given him a little bit more than the required amount? Or do you not care and say, look, dude, that's why teams have controls. Just sign it and shut up, or not a big deal? I was wondering what you guys think about it.
I think that's a mere formality. It's one of those, quirks of baseball. That's strictly a union ownership thing, and it happens far more often than people report. It's just one of those things. It's just inherent in the union business relationship. That's more agent-influenced than anything else.
I totally get that, and I was thinking the same thing, but at the same time, these contract stuff with the Mets just irk me, especially with the whole DeGrom thing hanging over everybody.
The DeGrom thing, is anybody surprised the deal hasn't been struck yet, or is that something they can put off? Quickly, Rich.
Not surprised. Spring training has 2.5 more weeks, and I still think they'll get something done. I think DeGrom wants to be here. I think the Mets want him here. The whole Brody factor, we've talked about that ad nauseum. I think something will get done.
Sam,
the only concern is that there's just been one extension after the other throughout the entire league. And, it just reeks of the Mets not wanting to negotiate with him after the one of the greatest seasons of all time, the win loss notwithstanding. That's the only thing that irks me about it, is this idea is like why negotiate at the highest end? He's bound to regress, even if that's to a 2 ERA. I think it's asinine, and I'm all about. I understand where some fans come in with the fact that he's 31 years old, but As far as I'm concerned, you know, and you need some semblance of team cohesion over the course of 5 to 10 years. So that's my take on it. And until I see that they've actually signed it, I'm going to be a little concerned.
Well, right now I say, you know, capitalism rules the day. This is just business. I see it as nothing more, nothing less for the moment. As we get deeper into this, you know, obviously my opinion is going to change. Let's transition real quickly to Gordy Van Wagenen's most recent hires. Al Leiter, John Franco, and Jessica Mendoza are now special advisors to the Mets. I still don't know what to make of it, but I'll just say this. Bob Raceman of the New York Daily News put it this way. He's taking control of the Mets narrative. I find that fascinating. Sam.
That's a great point. Brody right now is, you know, out front. And I'm going to loop back around and ask you guys a question of just little random tidbits I saw about Franco. But I wanted to bring up Jessica Mendoza specifically. It pisses me off that people will automatically say something like, you know, same old Mets, this is a ridiculous hire, it's all for show, what does she have to offer? And, you know, I know some people have hated on the commentating that she's done, but I think it's clear that she knows her stuff and she's a good baseball mind. And I guess I'll pass it over to Rich regarding that and what his take is. I mean, I forget exactly what Brody feels that she can help with, but I bought it, basically. What Brody was selling, I bought in the pitch about why Jessica Mendoza is good to have on the field, you know, in off the field, excuse me. Rich.
Well, I love it. I mean, as it relates to Jessica Mendoza, you have a young person, 38 years old, coming in, and I think that's good. I think there's, you know, there's the product on the field, which she will help with, and there's also perceptions. And, you know, the Mets are infusing some youth into their front office. You know, Brody himself, I think he's 44, certainly puts him as one of the younger GMs around. And Jessica Mendoza at 38, you know, understands the way the game is now and, you know, and maybe how the game is perceived now by the people to whom they're trying to market the sport. So great hire there. And let's think about Al Leiter for a minute. You know, one thing we haven't talked about is the Mets, he was in the Yankees booth, and the Mets just snagged the guy. You know, Al Leiter, granted, he threw that great game against the Reds, and granted, he had a couple of good years as a Met, but he came up as a Yankee. He's been in the Yankees booth. He wears the pinstripes, basically. When you think about Al Leiter, I think most people think of him as a Yankee, and especially now. And the Mets got him away from the Yankees and to be in their front office. I think that's great. And I do agree with Raceman. You know, the Mets are taking control of the narrative. They're like, look, you know, we like this guy, and we're not afraid of you guys. If we want to hire him and he wants to come, we're going to take him. You know, and great. They kind of stuck it in the Yankees' face a little bit, which is wonderful. So between that and Mendoza, you know, I think they're both great. John Franco, I mean, you know, he's kind of just here. He's always around. You know, I'm not sure. I guess now his role's official, but it always seems like Franco is around the Mets. So to me, that was sort of like a formalization of something that I always viewed as happening informally. But I think it's great. I think wonderful. All three of those moves.
So, Mike, before you take it from there, I just saw something where somebody was talking like Franco was kind of an asshole in the clubhouse and that he, you know, he's a schmuck, basically. And I think it's most likely just people spouting stuff off on Twitter. But, you know, I'll start with you, Mike, and then you could take it from there. Like, have you heard anything? And, you know, he's a Brooklyn boy. So what is your take on the whole Franco thing? I know a lot of people think he was overrated to begin with.
I heard those rumors. Don't know what to make of them. But we're definitely talking about a different era. You know, Brody Van Wagenen wasn't around for those days. So maybe he sees something in John Franco that can potentially help the Mets. He's been one of those players who hasn't necessarily been completely divorced from the team. He's been around, unlike others. So I don't know what to make of it. I just found what Bob Richman, you know, how he coined it, I just found that fascinating. The Mets are taking Brody taking control of the Mets narrative. The only real thing I take away from this, I don't know what to make of special advisors. I really don't. I mean, A-Rod's a special advisor for the Yankees, or was, if he's still on the books. And, you know, the Mets aren't the only team to do this, and just don't know what the end game is there, other than being, you know, a liaison, you know, and I was reading perhaps even a spy. I don't know. So I'm a little confused about the whole thing. It's not that I have a problem with any individual. It's just I don't know what the end game is, you know. But then again, I'm very happy with all the other front office hires. So I'm not about to complain about this. I'm just a little confused about it. That's all. Weird, you know. And the more I ponder it, the longer I'll go. So it's really time to get over to the more serious side of the of tonight's subject matter. Tom Seaver.
Yeah.
And sad. Go ahead, Sam.
No. Please, Mike, you take it from there, and then I'll do it. My thing.
Well, you know, this is sad to speak of. By no means do I want to make the mistake of eulogizing the man. He's not dead. He's alive and very well. Tom Seaver and his family broke the news in a statement issued through the Hall of Fame on Thursday that as a result of his condition, the man we call the franchise will be retiring from public life. And his family says Tom will continue working from their California home and on his vineyard. You know, so I'll leave it at that. Like I said, the news broke Thursday, and Sam, I think you have the most appropriate way to really delve into the subject matter. So go ahead.
So a few weeks ago, we were lucky enough to have Skip Lockwood, who was the Mets closer from 1975 to 1979, on the podcast. And he wrote an incredible book called Inside Pitch that I believe every baseball fan, let alone Mets fans, need to read. And he had a section about Tom that I think sums it up, and I'm going to go ahead and start from there. Every quality pitcher I ever met focused completely on preparedness, mentally and physically. Jim Palmer, in his book, The Art of Pitching, shared, "When I was pitching good, I could almost see where the ball would go before I threw it." At the top of his game, Sandy Koufax talked about pitching as being an extension of his body. From my personal perspective, the best pitcher in the National League, and maybe the best pitcher in all of baseball, was Tom Seaver. Immensely talented, Tom was a student of the game. He believed that the velocity, movement, and location of your pitches could vary greatly from outing to outing. Even a talented, dedicated pitcher will inevitably have to endure a slump. A pitcher needed to battle his way through it and limit the damage to a game or two. When you start to struggle, you should analyze your motion in a mirror. A pitcher must be sufficiently objective to detect and compensate for these differences. He believed that averages always, but that a good hitter sometimes will hit good pitching. He stressed certain things: avoid walks, get the first out of an inning, don't let the batter make contact with the meat of the bat, and don't let the batter claim both sides of the plate. I had trouble handling my emotions in between innings. Typically, I would come in from an inning and pace the runway leading to the locker room until I got a chance to go back out. The whole process of trying to stay so quote-unquote up was exhausting, and I was having difficulty throwing strikes when I returned to the mound. Every pitcher has to find his own method of dealing with time between innings. A passive-aggressive starter with the Pilots likes to spend the time glaring out at his opponents. A pitcher with the Brewers opted to play cards down in the runway. One of my Angels teammates meditated in between innings. I asked Seaver what he did. Tom reminded me of an old childhood game we played in the schoolyard, Red Light, Green Light. He said that when he went out to the mound and crossed the foul line, he said green light to himself, meaning that it's time to step on the gas. When he walked off the mound in between innings, he'd call red light, foot off the gas, to himself. So in between innings, he was off duty. Late in the season, the Mets were in Chicago for a midweek series with the Cubs. The game was scheduled as an afternoon game, and the phone in my hotel room rang at 9 o'clock in the morning. The familiar voice on the other end of the line, demanding that I get my butt out of bed. Quote, "We're going to the Art Institute to see something you will never forget," end quote, beckoned Seaver. "Meet you in the lobby in 20 minutes. Tom was a complicated person with many diverse interests. One was wine, which he has successfully pursued with great passion after his baseball career. He collected dirt from the various fields in the league for research. He studied various forms of art, and he loved going to museums around the league. We decided that in the time remaining in the season, he and I were going to see as many museums as we could fit in. We hailed a cab. Tom directed the Art Institute of Chicago. The Chicago Art Institute had acquired a masterpiece of Claude Monet, Waterloo. Seaver was my museum guide. We wound our way up to the third floor, which was dedicated to this one work of art. The inscription underneath the painting said, quote, "One instant, one aspect of nature contains it all," end quote. Monet produced this enormous mural at his home in Giverny. The mural was really a series of murals with a single timeless motif, a single focal point flower garden, or a smaller pond spanned by a Japanese footbridge. Seaver studied this painting in college, and he was intrigued to see it in person. We turned the corner, and the Monet stood before us. A museum guide related, quote, "In his first water lily series, Monet painted the pond environment with its water lilies, bridge, and trees neatly divided by a fixed horizon. Over time, he became less and less concerned with conventional pictorial space. By the time he painted his third group of these works, he had completely done away with the horizon line altogether," end quote. Tom stopped to see if I was paying attention, and the guide continued. Quote, "He created something called a spatially ambiguous canvas, as if he was looking down at it, focused solely on the surface of the pond with its cluster of plants floating amidst the reflection of sky and trees," end quote. "It was incredibly beautiful. Blues were vivid. The water was moving. I felt like I was dripping wet inside the canvas. The whole thing was alive. It took my breath away. We sat on one of the benches in front. Other patrons clustered behind. Always a relative concept, time appeared to stand still. I was lost in the moment. Tom woke me up. Quote, we've got to get going back. In this arena, it might be fine to contemplate the relativity of time, but if we don't make it to the stadium for warm-ups, we'll both be fine," end quote. Tom, in his own way, painted a canvas, and that was bounded by bases and wooden fences less spatially indifferent. Seaver believed that a fastball needed dimension and depth. It needed to be thrown through the catcher, not to the catcher. And I think that basically sums up all you need to know about Tom Seaver.
Well said. Well done by you. Well said by Skip Lockwood. Rich, retiring from public life is a rather delicate way of putting it. You know, dementia is a scary word. It's the general term, talking about memory, thinking and reasoning. It can affect physical performance and even behavior. And the reports argue in an advanced stage. So wherever you want to go with this, Rich, by all means.
Well, you know, I don't know if you guys have experienced that, you know, in your families and such. I have. And
Likewise. Likewise.
It's probably the most difficult thing, you know, I shouldn't say the most, but it's a very difficult thing because the person is very much physically alive, you know, and could actually be quite vibrant. But when the person doesn't remember you or remember things, and, you know, it's like the vitality is there, but it's a different person in the body. And when it's someone close to you, it's very difficult to deal with. And I feel for the Seaver family because, you know what, no matter who you were, you know, you were a professional athlete, you were an actor, a rock star, whatever you were, you have a family and you're human. And the people who are closest to you and have to watch this. And also, I don't know what stage he's in, but dementia goes in it's like we looked it up because we had it in our family, and it goes in very distinct stages. And there's a stage where the person suffering from it becomes very angry because they know that they're not themselves. They don't know why the hell they're not themselves. Like they could feel themselves slipping away. And I don't know if that's where Seaver is or if he's past that stage now, but it's very difficult for the patient, very difficult for the family and caregivers. And, you know, all of us and probably everybody who would ever listen to this never met the man, but you feel bad for him as a human being. And the fact that we won't see him anymore, we won't see him. Now, we're not eulogizing. We're saying we won't see him at Citi Field. He won't be there this summer when that day in July they're honoring the 50th year of the 69 Mets. He won't be able to be there. And if the Mets should win the World Series, God willing, he won't be at a parade, you know, to wave and, you know, and hand them the trophy or whatever and be part of the franchise that he helped put on the map. So it hits from all angles. You know, it's like think about a target, right? And it's got all these arrows coming at it. You have the family, you have the person, you have us as fans aren't going to see our guy anymore. All of that. It's hitting a lot of people, whether it's on a personal level or on a sports level or whatever level. It's a really terrible thing. You know, it is. And to Seaver's wife, you know, Nancy Seaver and their grandkids and all that and their families, I don't wish it on anybody, celebrity or not, and I feel bad for them. That's what I have to say.
Yeah, I've been exposed to it. Sam, I'm sure you've been exposed to it as well. Buddy Harrelson is also suffering from Alzheimer's, and we know Ed Kringle is well. He still needs a kidney. And there are Mets, you know, as you say, Rich, this is the 50th anniversary of the 69 Mets. You know, I don't know how many players they're expecting to show up, perhaps 15, 16, 17. I'm not quite sure what the number is, but let's not forget some of the players who passed away. You know, Ed Charles most recently, Don Clendenin, Tommy Agee, Tug McGraw. And I guess my point here is that, sure, let's introduce, you know, a statue dedicated to Tom Seaver for the conversation. But more importantly, I mean, I think the onus is to get this done while he's still with us. Now, I'll say that, you know, we know Kringle on Twitter, you know, from his blog and whatnot, and he put out a rather cryptic tweet out, and perhaps, you know, the Mets are in the process of, in fact, getting this done. You know, clamoring for a statue is suddenly all the rage, but Rich, as you know, while the sentiment is correct, the timing is a little off, because older fans like you and I, those of us, you know, whom actually witnessed his greatness on the mound, we've been demanding a statue for at least 20 years now. He was elected into baseball's Hall of Fame in 92, and the emotional grievance was filed shortly thereafter. But I will say this, while criticizing the Wilpons has become a pastime of sorts, Nelson Doubleday still deserves his, you know, share of blame as well, because he remained on as partner for at least another 10 years beyond Seaver's enshrinement. So I'm not looking to pick a fight here, but if there's a time to get it done, the upcoming 50th anniversary is obviously the most appropriate time to reconcile this long-standing and to some extent unforgivable oversight. Sam?
Something that the bobblehead got right was the dirt on the knee. And, you know, I obviously am not lucky enough to have seen Tom Seaver pitch, and lucky for Mets fans, they saw him in two different generations because they were able to get Tom Seaver back for a year. And I'll pass it over to you, Rich. You'd have to say that the statue, there, it could be in so many different motions of him in the middle of pitching. It has to be some sort of actual mid-motion, I would believe. Do you think that it's got to be the knee scraping? You know, that's just, when I think about it, I always think about that dirt on the knee with the bobblehead, and I'm just wondering where you are with that.
Yeah, I mean, the whole statue thing, you know, what can you say that hasn't been said already? The only thing I could say is this. Should it have been there a long time ago? Of course, right? I mean, it's not even a question. But the Mets are saying that the leaking now is that they were planning on doing a statue anyway. they were going to do something special for him. And, you know, you get the little reports leaking out that the Mets claim that, you know, before this announcement, they had a big thing planned for the 69 Mets and focusing on Seaver, which, you know, may have included a statue. Nobody really knows. But I'll say this. I'm going to hope and just in my mind until this notion is shattered, I'm going to say to myself, they were going to do a statue. They were going to do a statue. Because if it took this for it to happen, bad. Bad shame on them. You know, shame on them. If that's the case. And I'm going to say it's not. I'm going to say, I'm going to believe it. I'm going to take things at face value and say that they were planning something major because certainly they know that the fans have been screaming for it. So, okay. I mean, tell me if you guys heard something else, but from the facts that I've been able to gather would be the Mets say, yeah, you know, it's a terrible thing with Seaver. We were planning on doing the 69 Mets thing, which will go forward. We were going to do something special for Tom, and we'll continue forward with that. Even though he won't be here. Okay. And a lot of people are reading into that to mean that they were going to do a statue well before this announcement. So if that's the case, I'll be Pollyanna and say better late than never. Fine. Go for it. And I'm just going to sit here and hope that it wasn't because of the announcement that they've decided to do something that we all know should have been done.
You know, I'll jump in here as well. You know, we've been trying to give the Wilpons their due because we don't give them anything ever, and it's just but one thing after the other. I mean, just color me skeptical if I don't believe that they had anything planned, because one example after the other of their tone deafness when it comes to the Mets history is just rampant. And I've been lucky enough to meet Ed Cranepole, and I talked to him not even like Ed Cranepole. He talked to me like a fellow fan, and, you know, he has had his issues with the Wilpons, but it was a direct, you know, I can't exactly quote him, but he's not a fan of the Wilpons, bottom line. And I've heard that he tried to even put an ownership group together back in 1980, and it unfortunately didn't work out. And it's just one of those shoulda, woulda, coulda things. Like, what? It's one of those hypotheticals. Like, what could have been? Who knows what kind of owner Ed Cranepole would have been? But one thing I can tell about Ed Cranepole is that he understands the fans and he gets Mets history. And it just it keeps one. Moment, it's just we run around in circles about our exacerbation with the Wilpons, and the only person in New York that can give them a run for their money for worst ownership, there's news right now about him kicking a fan out for saying sell the team with James Dolan. So I guess the best thing I can say about the Wilpons is at least they're not a tyrant like James Dolan is, but the tone deafness. It's just one moment after the other, and this isn't necessarily what we should be talking about in the moment of celebrating Seaver, even though we're not eulogizing him. But it just brings up all these different issues. You know, Seaver's not – obviously, you and I, Mike, and Rich, we always talk about Payson, Seaver, Hodges. Somebody mentioned Hodges. Why isn't there a statue for Hodges? You know, this franchise is still reeling from his death, as far as I'm concerned. And unfortunately, this news about the dementia just brings all of these issues back up. It's sad from the dementia perspective, but it's sad that we even have to have this talk, that we're not just talking about visiting, bringing, you know, he's got dementia. Let's make sure that we're educating our kids when we take them to the stadium and go to the statue that's already there and talk about who Tom Seaver is in these amazing terms. It's the whole thing's just it's all sad all around.
Rich, I'm so with you as with you, Sam. I don't know if I'm going to be able to explain this well. Sometimes when you get so frustrated, you see, if this news didn't break out. And we thought that, you know, Tom Seaver was relatively well. Then it would be okay to any to have any kind of conversations regarding Lil Pump. We could be as derisive as we want to be. But now this situation arises. And sometimes you just have to set priorities. And for as much as I'd like to rile against them, I would just say, get it done, and I won't say a word. And I won't ever bring it up that it was late, this, that, or the other. Just get it done, because it's the right thing to do. Put aside any and all agendas, and just do it. I don't know if that satisfactorily, you know, explains what it is I'm feeling. But sometimes when you have feuding parties, in this case, fans versus ownership, everyone lays down their pitchforks and torches, and you know, you just come together for the common good, just get it done, and I won't ever bring it up. I won't ever bring it up. And then perhaps we move forward. I don't know. Rich, you interpret that for me.
I think that's right, Mike. I think, you know, again, was it planned? Was it not? It, you know, who cares in the end of the day? Get it done, and then we'll take it from there as fans. We'll be happy with it. You know, the organization will have done the right thing. And the pissing match of, you know, was it planned or not, and why wasn't it done in 19, you know, over at Shea in 1995 or whatever, all that goes away. It's done. It's there. And to me, that's going to be the most important thing, is that it's finally done. And then the other thing I'll throw into conversation here, I saw a little bit of a debate on Twitter today, but I thought it was kind of interesting. Where would you put it if it is a statue? Because we don't even 100% know that it is. We're just hearing rumors. Where would you put it? It's an interesting question. Somebody said it should be in the rotunda. It was Keith said it during the broadcast. Say it, was it? I think it was Keith. Right as you're going up the escalator, it's right there. But that's kind of where the 42 is. So would it be there? It's the Jackie Robinson Rotunda with a statue of Seaver. Is that where you want to put it? I don't know. Somebody else said put it down by the Mets bullpen. So in other words, that would be the right field side. You know, outside there, like, you know, in San Francisco, they have the statue of Willie McCovey. But put it on the right field side by the bullpen for obvious reasons. Don't know. What do you guys think of that?
I want it in a common area, away from the rotunda, the interior of the rotunda. I want it to be accessible to all, whether you're going to the game or not. I want a tourist to be able to come from Manhattan on the train, get off, get alongside it, get its picture, and be gone. You know what I mean? I want this to be something accessible to all at all times when permissible. I don't want it inside. If you don't have a ticket, you can't get to it. You know, they hid the home run apple out in right field. Nobody knew where the hell it was until everyone, you know, screamed and yelled, and they finally put it out front. That's all I'll say. Sam, sorry. I ranted.
I'm trying to, you know, get my Mets feet about me and picture the plaza. And I'm trying to think exactly where coming out of those stairs, which is a magnificent, one of the best parts of the entire City Field of design that they did, was just having that entrance, that subway exit. And seeing the stadium, it's breathtaking when you do it. Regardless of our qualms that we've spoken about of the details of Citi Field, that's lovely. And now with the home run apple there after the first year, it's even more spectacular. I think you got to put it somewhere over there. Obviously, you need to keep the plaza open for traffic, for foot traffic. So put it somewhere to the left. Put it somewhere to the right. But I think you got to put it somewhere in that plaza, whether it's somewhere with the fan bricks that you haven't filled in yet, or right out in front near where all those, you know, all those booths set up to try to sell stuff. that's really my take. It's got to be front and center, bottom line.
I agree. I think, I'm sorry, Mike, but where
Apple is,
I think, would be appropriate. But go ahead, Mike, I'm sorry.
I would say, you know the 7 P's, proper prior planning prevents piss poor performance. Wherever they decide to put it, if they should decide to, you know, make one, I hope they do so with the intentions of more and having them all form some relation to each other. Maybe that's asking too much.
No, I mean, you make a point, and if we're using San Francisco as a good example, I think they, now mind you, it's a more open, if anybody's ever been to San Francisco, you know, the water is not 126th Street, if you will, but people do go over, especially when the rotunda is crazy. People either go to left field, people go all the way around to the bullpen gate. McFadden, you know, has a big entrance. There's lines at the bullpen gate. There's lines to McFadden's when we try to get there, especially on opening day. So, again, you know, the statues in San Francisco, they're scattered around the edges of you know, the stadium. McCovey Cove, that's obviously where the statue is, and people traveled there to see Willie McCovey. But again, that's not the Chop Shops or whatever's left of the Chop Shops over there, which I actually found endearing, but that's a whole other story. So, you know, I could see, put Jones Hayson over near left field. I think that would be appropriate. People do go over there. I go over there. The one thing is that when you go around to the right field area, people do go over there, but that first area, you know, it sometimes gets blocked off for the players, so that is a little tricky. That's if we're talking about other statues. Rich,
well, you know, yeah, who's saying that it has to stop at Seaver, right? And I agree with everything you guys are saying, is that hopefully the Seaver statue will be the first one, as well it should be. And then there could be others. I mean, to me, number two, I know I believe Payson, yes. To me, number two should be Staub for all the philanthropic work he's done or, you know, had done. But why not? I mean, why not have Seaver in, you know, I agree, outside the ballpark, over around the right field there. I do think that's a really good idea, by the way, on the Mets side, right? The Mets occupy the first base side. So have the Seaver statue out there as the franchise. And then maybe have a Staub and a Payson one, and, you know, maybe have five, like, you know,
throw
two on the left field side.
I wouldn't mind Stengel, too. I mean, like, remember, you know that little statuette in the Hall of Fame of Stengel? I'd love a giant size of that if we're really just, like, tossing people around here.
I know the exact statue you're talking about. Look, some parks have them both inside and out. Philly has them inside and out. Pittsburgh has them inside and out. You know, it'd be fine if they get started, you know, and there's a lot they can correct by just doing the right thing. You know, Sam, I thought that excerpt from Skip Lockwood was just fantastic. Why don't you wrap this up for us and take us home?
Well, you know, I my last word is, my last word is awareness. And I think that the Wilpons could seriously use some sort of fan ambassador within the organization. Somebody who is substantially more connected, other than the social media people, other than the ticket sellers, you know. I just feel like there's somebody who needs to understand the pulse of the fans in a better way than the Wilpons seem to do. And it, to me, that title would be fan ambassador. And I'm not trying to vie for the job here by saying this. I'm just saying that it would behoove them to have somebody going, not just being out there on Twitter and understanding what the fans are talking about, but somebody who has been a fan and understands what this history is, but why we love this team, why we keep coming back, and even throughout all of this stuff, and it's something other than the fact that they're the alternative to the Yankees. It goes all the way back to 1962. The fans are what made this team when they outsold the Yankees in a year that the Yankees went to the World Series. I might be mistaken about that, but generally speaking, in the 1960s, the Mets, who were awful until 1969, and literally awful until 1969, outsold the Yankees, who weren't bad until 1965. So I think that they need to understand that in a better way. And, you know, we've also talked about it. As much as we want everything to be more Mets-related, and not just, you know, we had issues as much as, especially you and I, Mike, love our Brooklyn lineage. We want them to understand their full legacy and acknowledge the Giants a little bit more as well, especially considering that the interlocking NY comes directly from the last type of hat that the Giants wore, and had different incarnations of that throughout their history prior to that fixed interlocking NY. So I think that the way to do that is some sort of fan ambassador who understands more than the Wilpons seem to do what this team is all about.
Rich?
Yeah, you know, that's a really good idea, Sam, to have some like a guest experience person, you know, like somebody who really owns that. And that would be a good idea. And I guess my last word for this one is, you know, amidst all the good feeling, you know, that it's baseball season almost and there's real life action to talk about and we're able to watch it on TV and all that and gearing up for another season, which hopefully will be a good one, it's a sad day. It's a sad podcast as far as I'm concerned. It's been a sad few days in Metsville because the Seaver thing, you know, there's no turning back from that. You know, it's dementia, it's we all know what happens. I mean, it's just amidst the excitement of a new season and a young general manager and new players and all that, I don't know, that's my word. It's sad. It's just the sad feeling of the Seaver thing, and I guess that's where I am.
Oh, boy. I was born in February 67. 2 months later, Tom Seaver made his Major League debut with the Mets. I have nothing but my sincerest well wishes to the Seaver family. And with that said, on behalf of Rich and Sam, I will say, let's go Mets, and all the best to
let's go
the
Mets.
Franchise.
Let's go Mets.
Be well, everyone. Good night.